Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I see this story out of Piney Point, Florida. Evidently a little place near Tampa, where they've got these giant pools of wastewater that evidently are going to leak, are leaking somewhere. They're talking about potentially them, you know, cutting loose and basically putting Florida under wastewater. I mean, it's going to be underwater at some point down the road anyway, but this is, we're talking about really nasty water. And it's kind of like the dams in West Virginia that are leaking at the footer, where you start going, all that slurry that's being held behind this dam, which evidently there's one about the size of the Hoover Dam that I didn't even know, but it's leaking at the foot. It's not a matter of if it's going to cut loose, just a matter of when. So those 3,000 or 4,000 people who are downside, they will just be washed away when it happens. Imagine living in that neighborhood. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on what do we do with this? Because we need infrastructure. This, I would consider part of infrastructure. That's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you. And thanks for your patience with me this evening.
Anytime. So so this is leaking, yeah. Nasty, toxic wastewater. And there, look, this isn't the only place. This, there these things all over the country. And, you know, this is a problem.
Yeah. It's a huge problem. And there's a couple issues working here. One is that we privatize way too much stuff. And when you leave it up to private profit-seeking companies to do things like upkeep that don't probably guarantee them a return when they also probably have some insurance, they're going to let stuff like this happen. So privatization, not all that it's cracked up to be. Number two is that we do defer a lot of maintenance, and it is a bad idea. Anybody who knows a vehicle knows this, that you know, get that oil change, get that stuff done, because if you don't, sometime in the future, you're going to end up with a calamity that's going to cost you a whole lot more. And that is happening not only, as you mentioned, in Piney Point, Florida, but also in many places around the country in many different forms. You saw that with drinking water in Flint. You see that with bridges collapsing in Minnesota and other places. And you see that with, trains that are not functioning the way they should be, highways that are either full of potholes or too congested, schools that are crumbling, broadband that is ridiculously bad compared to most of the rest of the world. And it's no wonder that we have competitiveness problems and all these inequities and headline news like this, because we do need to invest in our infrastructure. You mentioned, you know, tomorrow it might be West Virginia, and it might be another place after that. And this isn't a Republican or a Democratic issue. It's not something that seeks out Democratic states or Republican states. It happens all around us. I'm glad Joe Biden is talking about this, and not only talking about it, he wants to do something about it, invest trillions in infrastructure. And Democrats want to do the same thing. And so we just got to get this across the finish line as quickly as we can and as in as large of an investment as we can possibly do this year.
Now, I heard Band-Aids work. Just put a Band-Aid over it. I mean, it's what we've been doing, because my problem is I'm so frustrated that our political divide has put us in this position where we can't get anything done. The fact that our infrastructure has been allowed to get to the point that it's at now is a sign of the failure of our political system to deal with our problems at hand. I mean, we're in a moment where we're still in a pandemic. Our economy's not good. Our infrastructure is crumbling. And we've got, you know, some people are still talking about who goes to which bathroom and who can play on which sports team. It's crazy. Just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the wrong debate. Absolutely, and of course they want to focus in on these issues where they think there can be some cultural divide or issues that will be divisive to Americans, rather than something that is incredibly unifying, like infrastructure, for instance. Yeah. And I realize, look, this isn't the sexiest thing to talk about. This is not, this is not a top shelf political issue. But this is like the meat and potatoes of politics and governance here, from the local level to the federal level. If you're a local elected official, you better damn make sure that those roads, that the potholes are filled, that the sidewalks aren't cracked, and all that other. And that extends all the way up. And if we don't have a system that can deliver people to their workplaces, or kids to school, or goods to market, or allow our society to function with great electrical grids and broadband, then we are going to fall behind. And we have consistently in these competitiveness rankings globally, and also with the American Society for Civil Engineers grades us in terms of how bad our infrastructure is. I think it's a gentleman's C- was their latest grade, which is not a particularly aspirational thing. I've always viewed us as at least an A- country, Rick. I mean, we have problems, but we know how to solve them. And this extends to a lot of different people from a lot of different parties. I mean, Eisenhower, he may have done some terrible things on some issues. He had the foresight to create the interstate highway system, which was pretty great. Or Abraham Lincoln with the Transcontinental Railroad and the land grant institutions. Or FDR, who was very pragmatic and just threw whatever up on the wall would stick to get us out of the Great Depression and get us into a new era and a new deal. And all of these big ideas produced results that still live with us today.
Yep.
And so that's what Biden can do. That's what the Congress can do. They can not only help us today, but help us tomorrow and create a legacy that will make us more competitive, that will bring us together with more equity, and that will provide jobs for the future as we transition to a cleaner economy as well.
I mean, we used to have statesmen who aspired to be great leaders and great statesmen with legacies. And what do we got? We got a guy, you know, taking teenage girls across state line. I mean, we've got serious problems. And it comes back down to policy. And I look at the Economic Policy Institute just came out with a new piece on the Section 232 cases on steel. And they pointed out, because people were losing their mind apoplectic over the fact that Trump had done something on steel. Turns out, evidently, you know, the price didn't go up, actually helped our steel industry, as I understand. And, you know, we still haven't done enough to stop the Chinese from dumping. But it's a start, I guess, from what they're pointing out.
Yeah. And you know this from being from a steelmaking area and a steelmaking state. These problems didn't just crop up overnight. They've been with us for decades, and countries realize that steel is a base material for manufacturing for national security, and so they want to make their own steel. We've realized that for more than a century now. Other countries are catching up. China has caught up and passed us in a big way. It makes 55% of the world's steel now. It doesn't consume all of that, but it makes the steel, and it realizes that it can be an engine of growth for itself. Well, a lot of presidents didn't take action. Bill Clinton didn't take action. Barack Obama didn't take action. George Bush took a little bit of action, but then took it off. And so Trump actually did take some action. And to Biden's credit, and to and mostly spoken through Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, said, look, the tariffs have worked for the steel industry. They've helped to stabilize it. There's been some new investment. There's been some hiring back. And writ large, the economy, before the pandemic, it was having a negligible impact on a lot of these other industries. And so as we move forward, there's a lot of these big multinational companies and even some of our allies who are like, why are you doing these steel tariffs? These are ridiculous. This is a Trump policy. But I think Biden, to his credit, is saying, look, this is helping a key industry that's important to our national security. And not only that, to our clean energy future. If we want to build all those offshore wind towers, that is a lot of steel. The volume of steel for that is unbelievable. If we want to rebuild America, reconstruct America, that is a lot of steel in the form of rebar and structural steel for bridges and everything else. And I think it would just be silly to suggest that, yeah, let's bring in the Chinese steel. We might be able to save a couple dollars because it's dumped and subsidized. But I don't think taxpayers, I don't think workers, I don't think we as people who value human rights or the environment want to be for that. And so that's why we need to defend the steel industry with those Section 232s and also to invest in our own future. Yeah. So we can make sure that we're guaranteeing this level playing field broadly internationally, but we're also investing here at home and making the right economic moves.
No, and my problem with it is you look at the Chinese steel, and I'm told by steel friends that it's not the same quality. We're getting a cheaper product. It's a cheaper price, but they're basically dumping it on us to where down the road, if they're able to put our steel industry under, those prices, I'm sure, will come back up.
Yeah, they will. And what ends up happening, and you and I both know this because we run our trade policy, or we have at least in the past, based on a philosophy, you know, kind of the Adam Smith, David Ricardo, that even if imports displace some stuff, they're still good for consumers, and so we're going to do it. So we still have one of the most open steel markets in the world. And so what happens when China makes all the steel, it finds its way to a lot of different places. It eventually finds itself here, but these other countries end up with surpluses of steel too, and they all try to park it here in the United States. And, you know, they don't, you know, but they don't absorb imports themselves. Like Japan doesn't, a lot of Europe doesn't. And so we do have to work with our allies on this, but that doesn't mean that they don't bear some responsibility. China does. They certainly do. And it's actually U.S. steelmakers that have faced all this import competition. And we've seen lots of blast furnaces close around the country, as you well know, Rick. And
yeah, this is one of those industries, in my view, that there are some things for national security's sake or for the good of the country's sake that you have domestic production for domestic consumption. Once you lose that industry, then you're at everyone else's mercy. And I think the pandemic has shown us, you know, as we give up industries, we become more dependent on others. Steel seems like one of those things that's a base component for virtually anything we're going to do, especially when we're talking about a $2.25 trillion infrastructure plan of doing bridges and transit and electric vehicles and all of this stuff. Steel's kind of in a lot of that stuff, no?
Yeah, it totally is. I'll give you a couple of very quick examples. One is electrical steel, grain-oriented electrical steel. That is used in our energy grid. That'll be used in electric vehicle charging infrastructure. There's basically one facility in the United States that still makes it, and it's in Western Pennsylvania, and it's finished in Ohio. And it faces a ton of global competition. Well, that facility obviously needs those tariffs so that they can help to rebuild this economy. And the other example is with respect to armor plate and plate that's made in one of America's oldest steel mills in Coatesville and then also finished in Conshohocken, Pennsylvania, close by to that. That goes in literally our submarines, our aircraft carriers, and potentially those offshore wind towers that I'm talking about as well. And so it is vital not only for our security, but also for our clean energy future. And also making all those new metals that will go into the EVs. The steel companies have been working very closely with the auto companies on how do you do that to make it work. And they're looking forward to this, but we do need to push back on those unfair trade practices abroad. And part of that is maintaining those Section 232 tariffs that started in 2018.
Now, you know, we just had a really good jobs report. I think it was like, you know, what was it, 916,000 or some just obscene number. Which is fantastic, but of those jobs, you're not looking, I think, like, what, 50, 55,000 manufacturing jobs, which means we're still more than a half a million down from where we were. You know, by keeping these tariffs, by doing an infrastructure plan, doesn't this get that engine going again, start making us manufacture stuff?
Right. That kind of investment, that public investment combined with a level playing field, can spur manufacturing job creation. And here's Joe Biden's challenge. In all the past recessions that we've had, basically since the 1970s, when we've lost factory jobs, we've never gotten back up and recovered all of them before.
Right.
Not in the Great Recession. But we have the opportunity to do that with this pandemic. Biden has about 500,000 manufacturing jobs to go. I believe he can do it because post Great Recession, we did add back more than a million manufacturing jobs. It left us in a hole, but I know that we can do this. And if Biden's the first president that can do that for the factory sector, I think he'll be remembered fondly in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan and states like that.
No, and what it also
But it's not only about that. It's about job opportunities for lots of people.
Yeah. Right. And what this moment is, why this moment is important is, you know, while China is becoming much more muscular, This is an opportunity to, now that I think as a country, we've realized that it's not going to be the paradise we thought it was going to be. Maybe we're able to claw some of those jobs back, incentivize the research and development, incentivize, you know, coming back here, because we are going to be doing a bunch of building if we could just get out of our own way politically.
That's right. They get, what manufacturers need is a market, and that they get that through a good economy, and also through things like Buy America, where the government is purchasing American-made products over the long haul. And then they need that level playing field. And so if they get that, we can have a bright future. We were number one in manufacturing for about 100 years. We lost that to China because the Beijing grew its manufacturing economy.
Yeah, well, I don't think we lost it. I think we gave it away.
Yeah, well, we gave it away. We totally gave it away. And this isn't about who's better, the United States or about China, but this is about, we know we can do this. I mean, we know we can make steel cleaner and more efficiently than China. We know that if we put our minds to it, we can build smartphones in the United States. Just as an Apple or no one else has ever cared about that. No one's made them care about that. But if we do, we can have a brighter future and good jobs for a new generation of Rosie the Riveters and of factory workers who can make some pretty amazing things that will leave a lasting legacy for our economy as we're rebuilding this country.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, I get it every time I bring this up, because, you know, we're on the same page. I get, well, you know, Americans don't want those jobs. I hear that all the time. I'm struggling with it because I think Americans do want those jobs. Those are good jobs if they're good union jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's the difference. There are some low-wage employers in manufacturing, just like there are in other sectors. They have the hardest time attracting talent. The union employer who has good benefits has a far easier time attracting and retaining talented workers. The thing that has held them back is that we were shrinking. We weren't growing in manufacturing for a long time. Now we're growing. We can get kids, we can get other adults interested in this, we can build pipelines for them, but it's going to take some policy to get
and
us
some
there.
Vision. You're absolutely right. Scott, I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff, my friend. Keep up the great work there at the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Likewise, Rick. Thanks. All the best to you.
Good stuff. Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Check it out. Right back after this. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.